Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Three Sides to Every Adoption. I'm Sarah Easterly. I'm an adoptee, and I'm joined as usual by Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard, who's a birth parent. Hi, Kelsey. And Lori Holden, who's an adoptive parent. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
And you may notice that we have a special guest with us today, someone who is has dual roles in the constellation, Ridge House, who is both a birth father and an adoptee, a late discovery adoptee. So hi, Ridge, welcome. We're so glad you're here.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much. We are really glad that you said yes to this invitation. I know you so well. Ridge is one of the facilitators with me running Adoptive Voices. So Ridge and I talk all the time. So I feel like I might have to just be quiet a little bit. I know more than, I don't want to tell your story. I want to leave room for you to tell it. But I'm so happy because we actually mostly talk in our adoptee roles and less in your role as a birth parent. And so we're glad to have you in this conversation because we don't hear from birth fathers necessarily all that often. It doesn't seem like there's as, it feels like birth moms are, you know, there is a vocal community of birth moms, and Kelsey is a big part of that community. But we don't hear from birth fathers quite as much and get to hear their side of the story, how adoption works from your perspective or doesn't work. What are the sticky points? What are the lessons you've learned? All of those things, I guess, I'm hoping that we can cover in the next little bit here. But before I jump too fast ahead, I guess let's just start with having you share your story as a birth father.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I was in my summer between my first and second years of college, and my fiance and I had broken up. I had moved to another state when I got a call from her best friend saying, hey, you should know that Becky's pregnant. And, you know, the reason that we broke up was infidelity. And so my first response to her was like, okay, and what? Like, it's mine. So it was a pretty kind of harsh denial. And I'm glad that it was her best friend and not her that heard that, because I was in a pretty kind of shocked and knee-jerk reaction. When I at that point I decided, okay, I'm gonna go back because growing up was a challenge. You know, I had alcoholic, abusive parents. Becky did not have a great family life, and as I started to think about, you know, our child, I wanted better hope. You know, more opportunity for that child than either of us really had. So we moved back. I moved back to where Becky was, and we tried to reconcile, but in the end, it just didn't work. I was far too immature to be able to handle both the thought of being a parent, you know, as well as overcoming the tensions in the relationship. So we had talked about splitting custody. We had talked about just other options to being, you know, a partnered couple raising a child together. And one night, I'm sure she said it out of frustration. She said, you will be paying for this child for the rest of your life. And while I had already known some terror in just daily existence, you know, this added another layer. Shortly after that, we had a couple that we knew whose sister and husband were looking to adopt. They had a couple of adoptions fall through. They'd had a couple of miscarriages. And so the couple we knew, Cheryl and Ray, asked if we would be interested in speaking with her sister, Colleen, and Colleen's husband, Brian, about the possibility of adoption. We met with them over, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. You know, I felt like we were probably in the second to third trimester when we met with them. They were from Colorado. We were living in Kansas. And we talked about a lot of things. And I think about what I know about adoption now and what I didn't know and what no one really talked about with adoption then. And so they probably, the potential adoptive parents probably did as well as they could, balancing both a desire to have a child and talking to us about all of the, all of the permutations of adoption. In the end, they came to the birth. They were in the room. I don't think I was in the room for the birth. You know, it was one of those hospital suites where it was just the mother. But Becky was wheeled into a maternity suite shortly after that. And Brian and Colleen were there for like 3 days. And so we spent the next 3 days in the hospital with our baby boy and Brian and Colleen. So that was 1990. I thought about, we had an open adoption, so I was able to see Zach pretty regularly. I mean, as regularly as being a state apart allows you to be. And Brian and Colleen always fulfilled, the letters and the birthday and all of those things. So I don't have a recollection of the time calling or sending a letter to say, hey, listen, I'm going to be, near you. I'd like to come by. We had lunches and walks and going to parks. And I was about as active as I could possibly have been given my amount of knowledge around separation, trauma, all of those things. So in the end, we probably had, a model open adoption on my side for, the 1990s. And I still wouldn't do it again if I had to go back in time.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Ridge. Yeah, thank you. I think, you probably were maybe you didn't realize, but you were probably among the pioneers of open adoption as well, right?
Yeah, I don't have the data for that. I know that open adoption was, I know that there were instances of it before, because it was clearly one of the models, but we were basically doing a private adoption. It was amongst the things that we talked about.
How did you and Colleen and Brian and Becky figure out those relationships when nobody was doing it yet and nobody knew what it would be like at that time? How did that kind of evolve for you all?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of shoot from the hip. We thought about, it's really interesting to look back at that now, because one of the questions that I had for them that determined whether they would be a good match is if they would let Zach have a mohawk if he wanted one. And I remember Colleen going, yeah, I guess if he wants a mohawk, he could wear a mohawk. And I'm like, all right, I'm sold. It's good enough for me. So I think that we had open conversations with each other ahead of time. At this point, I would have a hard time advocating for a pregnant woman having that much contact with an potential adoptive couple. Looking back now, I don't have I don't think they twisted my arm. I don't feel particularly coerced, but I think the environment can be coercive. And so I wouldn't advocate for the amount of contact that we had with what I know now. But, you know, we did have a lot of contact with each other. They came to Kansas, I would probably say once a month, you know, until the birth. And so we just kind of navigated those things, you know, with some honesty to each other. And we probably didn't express as many concerns. You know, I think a lot of those fearful conversations went under the radar or just kind of got tucked away. But I think that's probably how, Lori.
One of the things I hear, and Kelsey, maybe you can answer this too. One of the things I hear from birth parents living in open adoption, as well as adoptees, is that it's nice to have that contact, that ongoing contact, and you get that genetic mirroring and all the things that come from the contact. But for every hello that you have in those relationships, there's also a goodbye, and that can be hard. So over the time that your son was growing up, what was that like for you, Ridge?
Yeah, goodbyes were always hard, but given some other aspects of my life, it was kind of like a rainfall in the ocean. You know, the ocean was already there, and so those goodbyes were just additional rain without measurable results.
I sometimes feel like, for me, I don't know, because I, you know, there are differences, I know, with carrying the child for 9 months and such too, but I feel like the goodbyes are like twisting the knife. So, I get graphic with everyone, but that's
not, you know,
every time I feel like it's twisting the knife.
Yeah, biological mothers have a different connection. I mean, it's more work on your side, you know, you have more invested. And even for me, with as much investment in, you know, her prenatal care and being in the hospital and all that stuff, it was still hard to say goodbye, especially as he started to grow, because then it was like, oh, you know, I can show him how to throw a baseball or a football, or, you know, we can work on things together, you know, just having that father time. Yeah, it got challenging. But again, not in a discernible way. You know, I didn't have awareness of it at that point.
Sure.
I think what that says to me, what both of you are saying, is that it's almost like adoption relationships have to obey the law of physics, or that one about there's always an equal and opposite reaction. So if we talk about open adoption as only the positives for the birth parents, that you get to see him grow up, we're forgetting all the mini goodbyes and the mini griefs that happen at all that time too. And so I think looking at the whole thing.
The way that we talk about open adoption, we talk about it like, we finally fixed it. We finally found the solution. This is the medicine. This is the cure to all the, and it's not, it's something to, you know, lessen the secrecy and the shame part, but it doesn't completely erase those things. It doesn't completely fix adoption. And a lot of the pain of it is the nature of the beast, and it's not going to be altered.
Yeah, I think it's more, I think it's unbeknownst to me, it enabled Zach to be more adaptive to, oh, you know, here I see family, you know, here I see blood relations in addition to, you know, my adoptive family. So, excuse me, it gave Zach some of those opportunities for mirroring and to perhaps lessen, you know, some of that separation trauma. Yeah, but it's not a fix, you know, it's not a fix. I think it's better, but yeah, certainly not the answer.
And I don't think that we prep birth parents at all, surely not enough, but not at all really, for navigating the open relationship, because I think we're just kind of like expected to like know your boundaries and have all the answers and act like an adult when you've made me, like you've infantilized me this whole pregnancy, and you've made me, put me on a pedestal, you made me the hero, you made me the victim, you made me all, you've given me all these labels, and then throw me into a relationship, which is like the hardest relationship I've ever been in my life. And you're like, know your place, know your boundaries. And also when your kid grows up, you have to answer all his questions, and they better be good answers.
And you're like, and I think that, you know, there's no incentive. There's no incentive to prepare biological parents for
you're right.
You know, I mean, if somebody were to say, hey, listen, this is probably going to be one of the hardest things you've ever done in your life, I'd be like, oh, should I do that then? You know, like,
well, and just the notion that like, hey, this isn't about you, this is about this child, like, groundbreaking. No one told me that, and it took me time to figure it out and say, God, I did, but like, I know there's people that never do. And it's devastating on the child.
Ridge, it sounds like you all did that. You and Brian, Colleen and Becky did a fair bit intuitively, I think, working toward Zach. Am I right in reading that situation? I mean, how did Zach respond, however much you're willing to share? How did he do in those early years?
I think Zach did okay. There's a couple of other elements to the story, you know, that maybe we'll reveal today, you know, if they're relevant. But I think Zach did okay until like 11, 12. He was, I feel like I got to see him once a year, you know, for, you know, maybe a day or maybe a couple of days, you know, like over 2 or 3 days. And then by the time Zach was 11, you know, I had 5 other kids. So then Zach was playing with them when we would see each other. And so on that side, all of them, I mean, they never thought of Zach as anything but a brother. So those, you know, those relationships weren't subject to the same, you know, kind of strain or experimentation, you know, I mean, they just were. All of them had always known their Zach. So yeah, maybe intuitively we did some things right, as right as you can get.
Earlier you said that you wouldn't do it again. Is that a quote? You wouldn't do it again? Can you tell us more about that?
You know, a lot of the a lot of things on my radar at the time of Becky's pregnancy and Zach's birth, a lot of things on my radar were just basically survival mode. And as difficult as it was for me to make it through, as I thought about the additional strain of trying to get a baby, toddler, or child through at the same time, felt overwhelming. So, you know, I look at that now with some 30 years of other life experience. So I would have to know the things that I know now in order to be able to stand in that place and say, you know what, I wouldn't do it again. And it really has very little to do with Brian and Colleen. And it has everything to do with, you know, my own discovery that I was an adoptee when I was 35. Because when I met BioFam, I was like, oh shit, okay, all right. I see how family, you know, biological connections go. And it was vital for me to meet them and know them in just long relationships in order to really begin to understand myself, which is what I think Zach lacked. You know, even though we got to see each other, and we had an openness in communication. He was not able to like drill into, oh, these are the parts of my biology, you know, like I really get this. So, you know, looking back, I wouldn't do it again, you know, for that and other reasons, but you know, that's a lot of it.
Well, that is a fascinating piece. It sounds like you found yourself on the path that Zach had been on as an adoptee, but he'd been on it all of his child life. And this happened about your realization came about the time that he was becoming an adult.
He was 16, 17, you know, by the time I, you know, got into some of that knowledge. I found out when he was 16. No, he was 15. I found out when he was 15 by the time, and it really kind of, it threw me for a couple of years, you know? And so, I was, ghost, you know, just kind of.
I must feel like the rug being pulled out from under you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was basically 2 years of just trying to keep the, you know, wheels on the tracks. You know,
did Zach have any help to offer you, or would that have been inappropriate with him being the younger and you being the older?
Oh, no, I don't think that's inappropriate at all. You know, I reached out to a couple of adoptee friends when I found out, you know, and so I think the lived experiences of adoptees is important. I don't have a particular recollection. I mean, Zach and I talked about a lot of things. I don't remember a particular bit of information, though, that, you know, Zach shared that hadn't been found, you know, in other conversations or in literature, or that we hadn't talked about before. It just now came with a different context. You know, when you talk about seeing a therapist, 12, 13 years old, now I had a different context. Like, oh, okay, you know, so you're seeing a therapist because, you know, so it's information that's now relit, you know, in a sense.
I often try to ask questions on behalf of other adoptive parents like me. And so assuming an adoption is going to happen, can you tell us from the birth father's, from your perspective anyway, as a birth father, what are some things that adoptive parents can do well?
You know, Lori, I think the first thing they can do well is package their own shit, you know, do some work so that whatever they're bringing into the relationship doesn't fall on the child. So like, that's the first thing. And I'm not saying all birth parents walk in with the same issues, so to speak, but I see a lot of narcissistic birth parents. A lot of narcissistic adoptive parents, way more than I should, for the level of, you know, like home visits and, you know, agency communications and like, and if you want to, I mean, if you just want to look at narcissistic parents in the general community, like that's a killer for a kid, adopted or not, you know. So that's another
I need to know more on that. What are the behaviors of a self-centered parent? Like you mentioned visits. Are you talking about boundaries around visits and things like that?
No, I mean, I think some of the boundaries around visits are probably appropriate within the context of, you know, what is happening on the biological side, you know, of the family. Sometimes it's a mess. Sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes it's just fear. More about the, what I would say is the interactions with the child. You know, if the child needs to feel, you know, the need of the parents, living vicariously, or, you know, now finally we're parents, I don't know what perhaps led them to the place, you know, of not being able to have a child or choosing not to, biologically, create a child. But in terms of narcissism, and you know, it's like, so my adoptive mom, you know, of course I just thought she was my mom growing up. hugely narcissistic, always needing love, always needing attention. And it's like, hey, I'm the kid, you know, like I'm the kid here. I'm not supposed to be filling your love tank. Like I'm the one growing up. I'm the one, you know, with needs. But that, you know, that mother who's just like, don't you love me to do this for me? You know, I mean, just all of those subtle psychological manipulations that we don't, as children, and even as adults, sometimes we don't have the mental faculty to be able to navigate that with awareness and care and health. So I don't know that I can say much more about that.
No, I think that's really clarifying, because I think in my mind, I was thinking about ways that adoptive parents can approach birth parents. But what you recentered this on is, this is really about being the child in the relationship, and not, the parents are supposed to meet the needs of the child, not the child meeting the needs of the parents. And that's exactly where the narcissism or the self-centeredness and not doing your work comes into place.
And I want to add to that. I mean, I think I just want to say, I mean, the setup of adoption can be about the child meeting the parents' needs, right? That's very often that's just underlying. So that, you know, it you just need to be aware of that. You know, and certainly that's not to say there aren't children who truly do need homes, but it's not as big of a number as we have all been led to believe that number is. And so just being aware of that, and then working to keep that relationship hierarchical, right? I mean, the child, the adoptee, should not be taking care of the adoptive parents' needs. And sometimes it's very subtle. Adoptees can tend to just have a knee-jerk kind of survival trauma-based reaction doing this naturally. There's a bent to taking care of the parents' needs and looking after them, even, you know, all the way through. That was my experience. It's just, I was just so sensitive. I needed to take care of my mom in particular, because I didn't want her to leave me. I mean, my brain was doing that. That wasn't all conscious. My brain was just doing that. And so it's adoptive parents being aware of that, so that they're not creating those, not taking advantage of, inadvertently taking advantage of that, right?
And, you know, Sarah, I also want to say that, you know, one of the things I really appreciated about your narrative, you know, in searching for mom, and not that your mother's narcissistic, I'm not making a clinical, you know, kind of diagnosis here. It doesn't even have to be that level of clinical work. But, you know, when your mother said to you, we needed you in order to bring us to faith, you know, like that's a heavy, heavy burden, you know, even without any kind of narcissism at play.
Yeah, that definitely was not about me. And I think in her mind it was. So I will say that in her defense. But the way it was framed was certainly not with me at the center. Absolutely. I worry too, just, you know, I think I'm glad you brought up parenting overall to Ridge, because it's in this social media age, I think a lot of people in my circles use their kids to gain followers, to gain social media attention. Maybe it's not even trying to get followers, but just attention online, right? That's a form of narcissism, and it frightens me. And you know, where are the boundaries? Because I think there's pride in your child as a parent and wanting to kind of brag, and there's a natural, some of the natural pride is healthy, but then when does it cross that line? There is a line, and I think every parent needs to be mindful of that.
And it's one of the reasons, and I'm just going to say this because I haven't stated this publicly, but like if somebody listens to this and they're like, oh, hey, Ridge is on Facebook, I'm going to send him a friend request. I'm not going to accept it. Like, unless I know you and I've had face-to-face time with you. And not only those two things, but also that, like, I want you to know my family, because like photos of my kids for years are on Facebook, and they're on Instagram too, but Instagram is a different, like, you're going to have to dig You know, like, you're going to have to go back years on my Instagram to find that. If, however, you want to send me an Instagram friend request, go ahead, you know, but I'm not going to accept a friend request on Facebook unless I know you, you know, I've met you face to face, and there's a reason for us to be connected, you know, on Facebook. And I really feel bad, you know, because I'll get people who watch Six Word Adoption Memoirs, and they're like, you know, I really want to be in touch. And I'm like, yeah, reach out on Instagram, because Facebook's not it for me. Sorry, little aside. Kelsey, go ahead.
So I'm only 6 years just about post-placement.
Yeah. But and you've got a toddler.
And I've got a toddler.
Yeah. And that was my situation as well. Like, Zach is about 5 years older than Andrew, my oldest.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a weird transition. Especially in the open adoption, it's been a weird transition. But I gotta say, like, in my six years, I've never talked to a birth father. Mm-hmm. Which is, it's weird to say, because I do like advocacy work and stuff, and I never, like, except when I have worked in agency or law work, then I have, but as far as like advocacy work, I have never talked to a birth father like face to face, even though this is over Zoom. And it's, I kind of like find it emotional, which is really weird for that to be coming up. But I think, like, there's, when we talk about birth parents, we talk about them together all the time, but I think a lot of times people mean birth moms. So I know that there's got to be some theme for you of being like, because birth moms feel left out a lot of times in the adoption talks, but I'm sure that birth fathers feel even more ostracized. And it's tough for me because, like, I'm not an adoptee, but I'm the fourth generation in my family to relinquish. And it just kind of feels like this sick cycle at this point, like this ride that we can't get off of. And there's a lot of negativity towards the birth fathers in our family, obviously, because a lot of times they were part of the reason that this child was relinquished. And so I find it really challenging to not to listen to birth fathers in general, but like to seek them out and to find where they are. And I don't know if, like, I kind of don't know where I'm going with this, but like, can you tell me, I guess, a little bit about your experience of finding community and maybe like what birth moms can do to bring birth fathers in and kind of leave their baggage at the door as far as finding community?
Yeah, you know, that's there's probably three things, you know, and I try to put these little numbers in my head so that I can come back to each point. You know, I appreciate you sharing, you know, that this is an emotional experience, you know, just like hearing and talking, and because, you know, honestly, it should be. It's about humanity, you know, it's about things that matter. It's about life, it's about death, it's about love, you know, it's about losing. So like it should be emotional, right? That's what we're here for. The second thing is I went to brunch with a friend of mine, and at the brunch was a couple who were looking to adopt. And as they were sharing, you know, and I was really just a fly on the wall. I wasn't like interjecting and doing advocacy and all that stuff. But at one point, the husband said, the agency is doing something about, you know, letting us know about, you know, the birth mom. And how he said it, I was like, what he said, I think he said birth parent, and then he said profiles of the birth moms. And I said, you know, there's usually two people, you know, in a conception. And it was like the room just kind of came to a stop, and he was like, oh yeah, you're right, you know, like, I wonder why we're only getting this part, you know, from the agency. you know, and I would love to say that there's some secret club, you know, where all the birth fathers gather, you know, and we share a beer and throw darts and, you know, commiserate with each other about the losses that we've had, you know, not only the loss of, you know, in relinquishment, you know, but even the losses in life that led to choosing a relinquishment, right? I haven't found that club yet. And I know there's a birth father out there for every birth mother.
One thing that I really appreciate, Kelsey, you saying that, because one thing that it brings to mind for me is just power dynamics, which we talked about in previous episodes too. But I do think there's power dynamics in every relationship, right? And Ridge, you were describing some power dynamics in your relationship with Becky that affected your decision, right? Kind of the way she was, I don't know if threat is the right word that you would use that, but that was my, you know, my interpretation was it felt almost threatening. And that kind of put you in a different, you know, that pushed you towards adoption, perhaps. I don't know if I'm summarizing that the same way you would, but I think of, you know, power dynamics often in relationships, it often can be the birth father. I'm thinking of my own adoption, would not have happened if my birth father wasn't, and his family weren't pressuring my birth mother to relinquish me. And then when she had a change of heart at the hospital, there was a doctor who, there's patriarchy is I guess what I'm saying, that the power dynamic of patriarchy, the male doctor coercing her, and then my birth grandmother not even questioning it because she assumed it was my birth father's family had gotten in touch. And so it did, just the power dynamics, I think, all around adoption. And I think, you know, you alluded to it a little bit, Ridge, just the power dynamic of having the adoptive parents in the hospital room. I mean, there's power dynamics all over the place in almost every step of the way in adoption. And I don't know if there's anything that can be done about that, but maybe if everybody's more aware of it. And I just feel so thankful to you, Ridge, for being a soft-hearted birth father, and I wish every you know, couple finding themselves in a really hard situation with an unexpected, unanticipated pregnancy could hear from you. But I know that they probably won't hear from you. You know, just the nature of how we get to material, it can be difficult to find material in that situation. I don't know, anyway.
Yeah. There's a researcher out of CIIS in California. I can't remember what the II stand for. Anyway, his name is Philip Weglertz, and he's an adoptive parent. And his dissertation is on birth fathers. And so like he spent the last 3 years just kind of having conversations and trying to track things down and collecting, you know, Zoom interviews and whatnot. And Phil has been a very generous, you know, soft-hearted guy, and really made an effort to dig into more of the biological father side, you know, of adoption. But he was finding there's not a lot out there. You know, it's one of the reasons that he went this direction with his research. And, you know, when I started going to conferences, Kelsey, I appreciate, you know, your vulnerability here. I actually had the hardest time with adoptive parents. You know, like adoptive parents would show up at conferences and I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. Okay. And then I had the second hardest time with birth moms, which was hugely ironic since I'm a biological father. Right. And so I felt most natural within the community of, you know, LDAs and adoptees, we who had the least agency in all of the decision making. And I think that that's probably, and maybe this touches on your point, Sarah, that's probably why I struggled, you know, with like meeting a person for the first time and where they were within the constellation, you know, especially within the direct, you know, three. How much agency they exercised in the decision making, you know, determined how kind of resentful that I was. Now I'm I'm better. You know, I can talk to birth moms now and it's fine. Right. But it's an awareness that I had, you know, that was surprising to me. And maybe it goes to that power dynamic, Sarah.
I think working too in adoption, like we see such ugliness come because we see it in crisis mode. And, you know, I've gotten some really just like terrifying phone calls to the agency and have been on those phone calls where there's violence, there's whatever, you know, there's so many different factors, right? That play into adoption and into that choice. And so I think that there's been so many things that have like solidified my preconceived notion of birth fathers time and time again that have been like, see?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think, and then of course my own family as well. And so, but I also struggle with the future, I guess, too, where having an uninvolved by choice birth father in my son's life and how will that impact him? And I can't play the birth mother and the birth father part, and I'm not ever going to attempt to or feel like I can.
Right.
I have the right to. So I think for birth moms, I think a lot of us feel that conflict and that, and that I've gone 6 years and I've never even met a birth father. And so there's so much mystery surrounding that side. And when we talk about the triad, which I know we've really moved away slowly but surely away from this triad diagram, but really when you look at that, and you see the birth parent side, that's such a broken, that's not a perfect little angle. It's very broken in a lot of situations. And so it's not super accurate most of the time.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this reminds me, Lori, to go back to a question that you had for me, you know, what would I say to adoptive parents, right? And my comment is do your work. Same is true for, you know, biological parents. Okay, so an adoption had to happen. Okay, now start doing your work. Because you don't get into a space where you can have compassion for yourself, compassion for your child, compassion for your, you know, former partner, right? Unless you're really doing the work, you know, inside, building the nest for yourself so that you can move in the world with some care and responsibility and love.
And I would say that goes for regular parenting as well as adoptive parenting. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things, I was watching your episode on why is there money in adoption? Do we need money in adoption? And one of the comments you had made, Lori, was that, you know, that that we need money in adoption because, you know, home studies cost, you know, it takes people's time, whatnot. And as I was watching that, I was thinking, we need to have home studies for anybody wanting to be a parent, much less adoption, right? Like parenting, such a responsibility. And we're like, oh, like you're capable of biologically conceiving. Good luck, you know, have fun with that. Without any, you know, thought or plan, you know, not like I want to license parenting, although, you know, the argument can be made for it. But it's like, yeah, parenting broadly, you know, my wife and I raised 5 kids and, you know, they're in their mid 20s. And right now it's like, hey, do you remember that time when you, and I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to apologize. here's what I was thinking at the time. And, you know, I got it wrong. Sorry. You know, let me know what I can do right now to make up for that.
Yeah. The therapy fund, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, I think we talked about this in that episode too. It's just unfortunate that we're kind of growing along the way too, and we're doing our best, but I guess that's why we're passionate about making these this content available to help people with that, maybe learn from mistakes we've picked up along the way or experienced, and do better and do their work, have, you know, point to what work, where the areas of work need to be, right? I hope that's what we're achieving, and it feels like we pointed out a lot today. So
And I would say this, I know this is a phrase you've used before, Sarah, I'm not a monolith, you know. I'm a biological father with particular experiences, and, you know, I cannot speak for every biological father out there. But I certainly would like to see more biological fathers stepping up and saying, listen, here's my experience. Here's what I think. So.
Yeah. And being engaged in the adoption as you were, I think, I can only imagine Zach's perspective on that, but, it's touching, and I can only imagine that was a big hole, you know, that there wasn't a hole there because of that significant ridge.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, but we all have holes. Even when we're at our best, we have holes.
Thank you for joining us today, Ridge. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the conversations you all are having, and, you know, making this material available for anyone, you know, who wants to kind of hear more and dig in a bit. So appreciate all of you for the work that you're doing here.
Thank you for being willing to be visible on this when others are not as visible yet. Maybe you can, the courage will come for others to come forward. And I just really appreciate you confirming one of the mantras I've developed in talking with people, is that do your own work, people. You've said it several times. And I think that is really what I, as an adoptive parent, I wish I'd heard that earlier.
Thank you, Ridge.
All right. See y'all.